Hello, thank you for joining us. My name is Matt Gervais. I'm the site editor for SearchExchange.com, and today I'm very excited to welcome Tony Redmond to our SearchExchange.com podcast. Tony, thanks for taking the time to join me.
Thanks, Matt. No problem. I'm always delighted to talk about my favorite topic.
So, Tony, today we wanted to talk about what we're calling the future for Exchange administrators. Exchange 2010 SP1 has been out for a bit now, and recently SP2 features were announced. If you could, what are things that Exchange admins should start looking toward as we look at, you know, the end of 2011 and even beyond?
Okay, so I guess the first point I'm going to make is that Exchange 2010 SP1 was a bit of a mega release. By a mega release, I mean it contained a lot of new functionality and was really the completion of the vision Microsoft had for 2010. By comparison, SP2 is much more of the type of release that Microsoft originally anticipated to be the type of thing that you get in a service pack. In other words, while SP2 will represent and does represent the latest state of the software when it ships, it contains all of the known bug fixes at that point. It doesn't have major functionality enhancements of the type that we really saw in SP1, such as a totally reworked Outlook web app, web client, and, of course, the introduction of the UI for major new pieces of functionality such as retention policies and tags. However, in saying that, SP2 does contain some worthy and valuable enhancements. In particular, it introduces address book policies, a supportive method of segmenting the global address list so that users can be restricted to viewing a subset of the GAL. That'll be very interesting for people who have to host many different companies on the same Exchange infrastructure. And SP2 also includes support for a new wizard that takes care of many of the mundane and fiddly steps that are necessary to configure interoperability between on-premises Exchange servers and those that operate in the cloud, or Office 365. Microsoft's figures show that 46 steps are required in SP1 to configure this kind of interoperability, and the wizard reduces this down to 6 in SP2. So that's good. Automation is always welcome, because it eliminates the potential for error and it drives up quality. So I view those particular things as a particularly good thing. Apart from these points, I'm not terrifically excited by SP2. I suspect that the slowing that we see in SP2 feature development for on-premises Exchange reflects the growing assignment of engineering resources by Microsoft to focus on Exchange Online, which is, of course, the component of Exchange that runs inside Office 365. The same development group, and this is a really important point, the same development group handles both cloud and on-premises servers in terms of development. Given the hype around the cloud and the simple need to get work done to make applications such as Exchange and the other apps such as SharePoint work well in the cloud, you can understand why Microsoft would make that call, transfer resources from one particular focus area to another. I think it's going to be a bit of a balancing act for them over the next while as they make sure that they keep both constituency of their user community happy, you know. But anyway, to answer the question about what admins should be doing for towards the end of the year, well, clearly we'll have SP2 coming out, and there's some preparation work that has to be done. For example, SP2 requires an Active Directory scheme update to accommodate address book policies. You know, policies are a new object that are introduced into the environment. Policies have things like attributes. All of these things have to be introduced into the Active Directory schema. I also think that admins can start to look at Exchange and figure out what the long-term future of it will be in terms of platform choice. For example, given that virtualized Exchange is much more supported today for both Hyper-V and VMware, is now the right type of platform? Is now the right time, rather, to consider a virtualized platform for some or all of the Exchange components? And so if I'm coming from Exchange 2003 or 2007, maybe now is the right time to move as I move to Exchange 2010. Maybe now is the time to start deploying on top of a virtualized platform. Or, indeed, you know, if I'm not going to go with a virtualized platform, maybe now is the right time to move into the cloud. These are pretty fundamental issues that deserve a huge amount of research, consideration, and eventually a decision.
So, Tony, it seems, getting toward one of your points there, that Exchange admins should really start familiarizing themselves with virtualization. If you could, what would you say are the top 3 or even 5 things that Exchange folks can start with when it comes to bridging that gap between their current skill set and learning about virtualization?
That's a really good question. I guess the first big decision that has to be made is what platform to use. There is a choice between Hyper-V and VMware. Both of them support Exchange 2010, both do a good job, and there's lots of documentation on the Microsoft and VMware website to read about how to deploy Exchange 2010 successfully on the platform. I suspect that the answer that eventually comes out will be heavily influenced by the choice that a company makes for its preferred virtualization platform. I can, for example, see many CIOs allowing Exchange to be deployed in one hypervisor and the rest of the application suite in another. So that's a big thing to take into account. The second factor that comes into my mind is to decide what components of Exchange to virtualize. Hub transport and client access servers are no-brainers. These are essentially servers that don't carry around much data, so you know they're pretty stateless. They should be easy to plug into an environment and take out. And a lot of work has been done by Microsoft over the last number of years, particularly in 2007, 2010 releases, to move these components to be essentially stateless, and to permit this swap in, swap out kind of attribute. So they're really easy to virtualize. I think a lot more discussion is required when you start talking about mailbox servers, especially those that are deployed inside a database availability group, where you have to be careful not to create a conflict or confusion between the application-specific high availability features, such as those that Microsoft has built into the database availability group, and the platform-specific high availability features that are part of VMware or Hyper-V. For example, if you took snapshots of heavily loaded mailbox servers and expect those snapshots to be valuable, that might be problematic. If you try to revert back to a snapshot and suddenly expect a heavily loaded mailbox server to be able to roll back to a point in time and suddenly join a DAG and all happiness and light to be there. So, you know, there's some work there to figure out how to use virtualization effectively with mailbox servers. I do like physical computers for mailbox servers, especially at the high end, but I totally understand that some people prefer and indeed have experienced enormous success by virtualizing everything, including mailbox servers. And you know what? If you have the expertise, and you have the time, and you have the luxury to go and prepare well, then yeah, go for it. I mean, the software has been tuned for virtualization, so all is well. But if you do go along, if you're new at this kind of stuff and you're thinking about going along this route of virtualizing everything, I think my guidance is to be very, very sure that you understand your operational environment backwards and forwards and are prepared to be able to handle the different types of outages that can occur. So you know what's going to happen at the application layer, you know what's going to happen at the hypervisor layer, you know what's going to happen at the hardware layer, and be able to handle all of these type of interactions. Virtualizing a complete Exchange organization is really not an exercisation for those who are beginning or starting off their journey for virtualization. The third point I make is that tuning and configuring virtual servers and the whole environment itself is a science that is somewhat different to physical computers. In physical computers, you actually can see them. You can see how things are working. Virtualized systems, though, the tools are getting so much better, and there's some really neat third-party tools on the market to help you manage these environments. Maybe it's still not as easy as physical computers, but again, my preference is physical computers, so I'm a little biased. I do think it pays to gain expertise in the field by deploying a solid test environment that accurately mimics your production systems to figure out whether or not the configuration that you've chosen can handle the expected load, especially in the storage subsystems. And the last point I throw on the table is that to remember that there are other virtualized solutions outside Hyper-V and VMware for Exchange. For example, I've been really impressed at some of the huge fault tolerance that Marathon technology has been provided for Exchange since Exchange 2003. It takes a completely different approach to the type of things that you do with VMware and Hyper-V. It's based on Zen technology rather than the other two hypervisors. But you know what? Sometimes when you need the absolute total highest level of fault tolerance, you have to look outside the envelope that people normally look at when they're considering virtualization.
Thanks very much, Tony. I'm sure our listeners will find this very helpful. So, unfortunately, we're out of time here. And, of course, I don't think we could have any Q&A these days without talking about the cloud and Office 365. So, it seems a lot of Exchange admins to talk of the cloud, talk of Office 365, worried that, you know, they may lose their positions. But I remember a few months back at your talk at the Connection show that you suggested admins should try and embrace the cloud and use it to use it to their advantage. You mentioned they can strengthen their skill set and add lots of value by learning about the cloud. If you could, you know, what are a few things that folks can do in this light?
Well, the first thing I'd say back to you is that there is a natural fear among the administrative community that some people are going to lose their jobs as a result of companies making the decision to go in the cloud. I treat this as almost being inevitable because, you know what, every time we have a fundamental shift in exchange technology, opportunities are created. And the sad fact of life is that those who can seize the opportunity prosper. In other words, if they can see new things to do, new value they can deliver to their companies, they're absolutely going to prosper. Those who stay fixed in the mud and try and keep on doing things the way, same old way, will eventually end up losing out. And it could be losing out by losing their job. It could be demotions. It could be anything.
Sure.
But, so essentially, this is an opportunity to seize the initiative rather than just lie back. I think that if we look at what's likely to happen in the market, I believe that Office 365 will absorb a large percentage of the Exchange installed base over the next couple of years. I've heard guesses of up to 40%. My gut feel is that the percentage will differ depending on the segment of the market you're dealing with. So, for example, companies who run Exchange 2003 today have to migrate to something else in the near future. The traditional approach is to go to the current release of Exchange. But now they have a binary choice. They can either go to on-premises Exchange 2010 or they can move into the cloud with Office 365. And I think a lot of small to medium companies who run Exchange 2003 will opt to move to Office 365 simply because the technology works. The move is reasonably easy, especially if you're small enough to be able to offer a one-time big bang move, if you like. And it frees up resources for those companies to be able to dedicate to possibly more valuable projects. Because let's face it, most small to medium companies aren't really focused on email. So if they can get off, you know, running their own dedicated versions of Exchange and go and use Exchange Online as part of Office 365, that makes an awful lot of sense. And that's the reason why a lot of CIOs are excited about this. On the other end of the spectrum, however, companies that run Exchange 2010 today might well consider, probably consider, that the pain of migration is behind them, that they've invested to get to Exchange 2010, and they want to realize some benefit from that work. And you also look at the other investments that they've made in things like the storage and the hardware that they've employed to run 2010. And they may look at the whole cost equation, and they look at what Office 365 delivers in terms of functionality and come to the conclusion that it really doesn't, that going there doesn't really generate more value for them. And then, of course, you've got companies who are large and distributed, maybe multinational, running a variety of clients and servers, might just find that the migration effort to Office 365 is significantly more than, let's say, the marketing literature indicates. So the upshot of all of this is that we will see different segments move at a different pace, but the significant thing at Office 365 will have a huge and fundamental influence over the market, and that's something that everybody has got to be able to handle at an intelligent level. There's no point in running away from this.
Okay.
So admins who don't want to lose their job need to figure out how to embrace and surround the new paradigm so that they can be perceived as somebody who enables change and extracts value from that change for the company. For example, make sure that the migration happens as smoothly as possible by anticipating likely problem areas, such as the non-support for public folders, and figuring out solutions to those problems, or by determining on a really factual basis the advantages and disadvantages for the company for each of the available platform choices so that the executives can make an intelligent decision. Or even by figuring out how to use different parts of Office 365 to solve business problems for the company. So, for example, if the company moves to Office 365 for Exchange Online, you know, why wouldn't the admin suddenly start taking advantage of things like SharePoint Online to solve some really, they might be small at the start, but they might be larger later on, but they're business problems. And if you solve business problems, you add value. But I guess the important thing at the end of this is not to become embedded in the same old way of doing Exchange. We live in a world where change is pervasive, and the IT world is the biggest example of that statement. So why would Exchange be any different?
Okay, well, thanks a bunch, Tony. As I mentioned, unfortunately, we're running out of time. So I wanted to thank Tony Redmond again for joining us today. Tony, do you have any final parting words for our listeners? Any words of wisdom?
You probably tell me that I've spoken too much, so maybe we'll just leave it there.
Okay, fair enough. So thanks again, Tony. If anyone listening has any questions or comments regarding today's podcast, please feel free to write me at editor@searchexchange.com. Thank you for listening.